listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our ongoing conversation with the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, Joe Loria, with a review of the top stories at the website, consortiumnews.com. Well, Joe, while all of the rest of the media today, so far this week, has been consumed with the funeral arrangements for George H.W. Bush, consortiumnews.com has been taking a look at some of the actual history of Bush 41, as they call him now, and his son even called him 41. I guess that's just the way they name presidents now, by number.
Giving you a number and taking away your name.
That's right. That's right. Hey, wow. Secret agent man.
That's right.
Let's go through some of the stories that you guys pulled out of your own history, really. Robert Parry and analyzing George H.W. Bush more or less contemporaneously as he, you know, his policies were unleashed upon the world. So start first, with the death squads, right?
Yeah, first I want to say I have not looked at 1 minute of any of the coverage of Bush because I didn't need to. I know exactly what it is.
Yeah, we lived there. We saw that live.
We know what it is. And as I pointed out on Facebook, there's something useful about the deaths of American presidents, and that is it exposes the myth-making function that the corporate media has. They're doing it all the time, but often it's subtle and we don't really know how they're doing it. But when it comes to the death of a president, how the corporate media covers this in both television and the press, you see that their job is to create myths about America, about its greatness, about its spreading democracy, et cetera, exceptionalism, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality, of course, as your listeners know, or they wouldn't be listening to you, I hope there are some out there who are learning something new. They know that the reality is far different. And what better way to do that, to counter that, was to bring back out of the archives of Consortium News the many, many articles that Robert Parry wrote about George H.W. Bush, particularly surrounding Iran Contra and the October surprise.
Yeah.
This is what Bob's great journalist accomplishments were. He brought the name Oliver North to the world when he exposed the Iran Contra scandal taking place inside the White House. Of course, buying weapons from Iran, the great evil country, and through Israel, middlemen, and then selling them to Nicaragua Contras after Congress had cut off funding because of the massacres that of civilians that the Contras had undertaken. And that was a complete violation of the Constitution. It's up to the Congress, of course, to allocate money, not the executive branch. So to do that was one of the worst scandals in American history that gets overlooked somehow. Watergate gets much more billing. And I think what Reagan and Bush did there was perhaps maybe even worse than Watergate because of their totally unconstitutional role, and also because of the people died, and really, who died from Watergate? People died because of Iran-Contra in Nicaragua. So, and the piece we have up now, the Bush's death squads that Bob wrote on January 11, 2005, is really interesting because, again, it's about people dying, and it's about the decision during the Reagan-Bush, George H.W. Bush as vice president administration in the 80s, to fund terrorists, really, civilians and leftists in El Salvador. And what Bob does in this piece is to draw a line from that El Salvador option, as it came to be known, to the Iraq War after his son had invaded Iraq. They discussed, at the time he wrote the piece, they were only discussing, but then later implemented, what they called the Salvador option, which was to fund terrorists, essentially. And they then, we've seen that happen then in Chechnya. We saw it certainly now in the Syrian war, where the United States and its Gulf allies have funded terrorists to try to get the political outcome that they wanted. We saw this in Libya. It's become U.S. policy, and it pretty much started at least, continuous way from El Salvador to Iraq and now on to Syria. So I thought this piece by Bob was really not only looking back again, one of the evil legacies of George H.W. Bush to counteract the unbelievably puffy coverage in the corporate media, but it also it nails down a really important part of U.S. foreign policy that stretched now over 30 years.
Yep.
I need to I want to give a shout out to Sam Husseini, because about an hour after Bush died, Sam tweeted one of Bob Perry's articles, and that's when I got the idea. I may have gotten it anyway, but I said, "Damn, that's a good idea." So I went back and pulled out these four articles to really lay it out there immediately in this at the same time as the corporate media was doing their thing. We did our thing, and hopefully, we've had some influence on some of our readers to think about Bush in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that that Sam Husseini is spreading around some of Bob Perry's work too. It's hard to ignore people when they're right, you know. This piece, the first piece that we're talking about here, that is titled "How George W. Bush Learned from His Father." It's under the Bush's Death Squads. Original title is "How George W. Bush Learned from His Father." As you said, written January or reported January 11, 2005. This is less than 2 years into the second Bush, second Iraq war, and a look back at it. And at that point, Robert Perry is drawing lines between what George Bush 43, or W, was doing in Iraq with what his father, 41, or HW, had done in Iraq. And before that, as he was running the operation Iran-Contra as the shadow president slash vice president under Reagan. There's actually, you know, a lineage that goes back with Bush into the CIA back another decade or two, where you have essentially the CIA recruiting the most backward elements in a society and militarizing them. This is what we still see playing out today with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and such in the Middle East. This is what was done in Latin America with Bolton and his predecessors, Negroponte, down there during Iran-Contra. And we'll go back to Guatemala even in 1950s. This is the U.S. pattern has been to do exactly the same thing.
Well, that's right. They probably did something like that in 1954 in Iran. Yep. Where they took religious extremists as well, And yes, this is a long, unfortunate, long pattern that we see, and it's explained very well in this story, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So, sorry. So we have that. That's one piece that is covered there. There were five pieces altogether, looking back at the life yes. of George H.W. Bush.
If I could add, yeah. Don, when Bush was CIA director, it was after the Church Commission, the Church Committee reports, yeah. which had a huge blow against all the intelligence agencies because it unveiled huge numbers of crimes that they'd committed since they were established with the National Security Act. In 1947, I'm talking about the CIA specifically. The NSA came in 1950, and the FBI had existed before that. So we learned a lot about what these intelligence agents were up to, and there was an outcry, and there were huge reforms. Of course, the FISA court was created because of that commission, and also the intelligence house and Senate intelligence committees were created. So for a while, they cut the staff at the CIA drastically. The CIA was cut at the knees. When Ford became president and Bush was vice president, he created what was called the Safari Club, which was their own private, off-the-books intelligence group to do the kinds of dirty things that would not be known by the new intelligence committees. And because they weren't funded by Congress, by the taxpayers, they got private funding to do that. So that's one of Bush's legacies, too, as a CIA director.
Right. I mean, the Church Committee convened and pretty much wrapped up their business in 1975. Bush becomes head of the CIA January of 1976.
Yep.
And that whole... at the time, we were looking at it like it was a house cleaning, but it turns out to have been that whole whitewashing.
Eventually, yes. Yeah. I mean, there was some hope at the beginning, and I think some of the intelligence committees may have taken seriously at the beginning, the FISA court and all that, but it didn't take long to evade that, and they do it very well today. They completely manipulate those committees. I'm talking about the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. In particular, they run the Congress oversight, you know, set it the other way around, the way it's supposed
That's
to be.
Right, right. Well, here, we're going to do oversight on your committee. Oh, what's that file with my name on it that you're holding? Who's she? Yeah, you know. It's
okay,
an interesting
next
relationship.
Question.
Yes, exactly. How much funding did you want? So, so we've got, you know, we've got a whole bunch of nefarious activity that the CIA has been, you know, caught in the midst of over time. Depending on which continent you want to, you know, meander across. You know, looking at the remains of Patrice Lumumba in Africa. How many dead bodies across Southeast Asia, you know, Latin America, et cetera, et cetera. Let's look at some of these other stories now. That you know, kind of shows some of the taking a Bush secret to the grave. This one, for example, this is from.
Bob went back and he wrote this in September 27, 2011, so 7 years ago. He was still working in 2011, he was still working on the October surprise story,
right?
Which is, of course, to lay it out briefly, was that the Reagan campaign, not elected, the candidate campaign and his team had contact with the Iranians and got them to withhold the release of the hostages, the American hostages in Lebanon, because they had influence over Hezbollah. So they were able to, I'm sorry, I'm talking about in the Iranian embassy. What am I talking about? In the American embassy in Iran.
Right.
So they had direct control over it. So they got the Iranians to withhold the release. So that the release, the idea was, would have helped Carter win the election.
Right.
And in fact, they withheld them until the moment, the very moment that Reagan was being inaugurated. I mean, that was as fishy as you can get.
Yep.
I can't believe they had the gall to do that, as if that may raise some questions. But they had such confidence that this would never come out, that they were able to do that, to stage manage not only the withholding of Americans being held, for several months more, but then released them just as Reagan had his hand on the Bible. I mean, and you talk about chutzpah. So Bob worked hard on this, both at Newsweek and then at PBS. And Newsweek, of course, killed his stories on this. And then he went to PBS and did a documentary. And more or less, he said that they think they proved it about 90%. that this is what happened. And part of the story was where George H.W. Bush was. Was he involved with negotiating this directly with the Iranians in Paris? The Bush said he never went to Paris. And of course, Bob in this piece is showing that he did by going back and looking at real estate records and where he said he was, etc. So it's quite an involved story that seeks to show that Bush was lying, not for the first time, that he was not involved directly in these negotiations in Paris. So it's a great read. It really is.
You know,
and again, undercuts Bush's legacy.
That whole affair, by the way, the whole Iran-Contra thing, but starting with the felonious tampering with U.S. foreign policy in order to manipulate the outcome of an election.
Logan Act.
Logan Act, the colluding with an enemy of the United States of America.
Right. Treason.
Yeah, okay, all of that. In the middle of all of that, the Americans are criticized as being historically amnesiac. Actually, that particular case brought like a new level of amnesia to American politics, because every person that they got hold of that had anything to do with Iran or the Contras or any of the funding mechanisms or the crack that was being imported into the country, all of that stuff that was all tied together, every person that they got on the stand from the administration could not recall.
Yeah, they weren't reading Consortium News.
That's right.
Bob Perry dedicated himself to combating amnesia. And he was writing about this into 2011, something that happened in the 1980s. Yeah. 1980, actually, the election of 1980. So you're absolutely right. This is another function of the corporate media, in addition to creating myths, is to bury history. You remember what Winston Smith's job was at the Times of London in Orwell's 1984. His job was to go back into the archives of the Times of London and change it. If they said there was going to a 5-year plan to create so much wheat and they didn't do it, he'd go back and change what the goal was to meet what actually happened, stuff like that. So he went in to tamper with history in the archives. And this is pretty much what the corporate media does on a daily basis. They bury recent history so they create no context for which Americans can understand what American foreign policy is all about. We just did that in the first segment of our program. We talked about the connection between the El Salvador terrorists and the terrorists in the Middle East that are being used today by the United States. If you don't talk about the history, you don't explain that, it's hard to understand what's going on today. You need historical context in journalism, and there's none of that in the corporate media. And on purpose, they don't want us to remember. They want us to have amnesia, so these crimes can be committed again and again and again. And Bob Perry dedicated himself by founding Consortium News to continuously go back into the recent history and link it to today as well, and show the importance and the need for that context.
You know, then there's another story that Bob Perry had reported. This was 24 years after the fact. Another instance of George H.W. Bush and the CIA and a case of state-sponsored terrorism. The article entitled, actually, George H.W. Bush, the CIA, and the case of state-sponsored terrorism. And this is the car bomb that blew up in 1976. September 21st, 1976, and that killed the ex-foreign minister of Chile, Orlando Letelier, who was the foreign minister under President Salvador Allende. He was murdered in a car bomb that blew up on Mass Ave down in Washington, D.C., and Bush...
Middle of the afternoon, if I believe.
That's correct, yeah.
Yep.
And it was a remote-controlled bomb, and it was an embassy row. And George H.W. Bush leaked for public consumption an assessment clearing the Chilean government, in other words, Pinochet, which was run by this guy Contreras. In other words, it ran cover for the people that committed a political assassination right here in the United States.
The Capitol, in the afternoon, it also killed a young woman who worked at the Institute for Policy Studies, where the Delalier was working at the time in the think tank there. So two people were killed, and Bush knew about it, and he covered it up. And Bob gives the story in great detail. And this you're not going to read about in the New York Times or the Washington Post this week, while he's being lionized as one of the great men of history. And this is the things he did. This is facts, you know, but facts don't seem to matter to newspapers when a president dies. All of them, no matter what party. It's because they need to continue this myth of the leaders of our country being stalwart men, great men of statesmen who want democracy, without that, this country, they're in trouble. Because the society would kind of, I wouldn't say dissolve, but there would be problems if the facts got out constantly about who these guys were. There would be an unbelievable demand for change. They wouldn't be able to go along with another string of presidents, whoever they are, no matter what they said during the campaign, even sincerely. Once they get in power, they've got to continue this foreign policy that is not established, that has been established a long time ago and is not reestablished by a new president. They have to follow this or they're in trouble. So in order to continue that going, they need to show that each president was a great man, even though they ultimately were evil men just for going along with policies they may not even have agreed with. I happen to think Bush did agree with this, given his background and the kind of man he was, the patrician that he was, the disdain for the average people. That's how he lost. People say today, even the corporate media is saying he lost to Clinton and that he didn't get a second term because he didn't know what a scanner was at a supermarket checkout.
Right.
And that was symbolic of his not giving a damn about the average people. And anybody was in, who, you know, with half a brain would know that he didn't care about the average people. But he did that. And that was a big mistake because it proved it. You know, it showed to everybody what people probably should have known already, that he was an extremely privileged individual whose father was a senator and his son became president as well. And he made a fortune. And in the guy, you know, probably worked for the CIA before he became CIA head chief. You got to get these facts out. And this one about the death of Letelier is just so, you know, blatantly corrupt to cover up for a military dictatorship in South America when they assassinated two people, including an American citizen, a woman, a young woman, in the middle of Washington, D.C. on a fall afternoon. And Bush, you know, said, wait, you know. But as Bob points out, the CIA, 12 years later, admitted it. This always happens, of course. Truth then comes out, and it's a footnote in history when it should have been the main story at the time. And the press, if it was doing its job, would be digging this out. But they didn't. And when you did try to do your job, as Bob did, you get your story spiked. So you quit in disgust, as he did, and started Consortium News, you know, where I'm really happy to be running the thing and be able to resurrect his stories as they're burying Bush.
Yeah, I'm glad, too. I mean, because another point, you talk about these things becoming a footnote in history, but as a matter of fact, when they go back to revisit the history, they seem to miss the footnotes. Because nobody's mentioning any of this stuff again. They're talking
It was two paragraphs on page A39, and the researchers didn't find it. I mean, it's unbelievable.
What about the front page of the New York Times in December of 1991? December 1992. Bush pardons six in Iran affair, averting a Weinberger trial. Prosecutor assails, quote, cover-up, close quote. Bush diary at issue. None of this comes up. And then talk about, at the heart of it, was Bush's protege, Robert Gates. Sound familiar?
Yes.
You know, we see Obama and George Bush Jr. standing around Daddy and the circle of friends. And you'll understand why Robert Gates was still a player during the Obama administration and why you have Michelle Obama ready to, love Bush to death, as she put it. If only.
Yes. Well, she succeeded. He's dead. So,
work.
You know, that front page story from the Bush pardon six, including Weinberger. I got the whole list here because Ray McGovern wrote a piece off of that.
Yep.
In which he named everybody who was Alan Fears, the CIA's Alan Fears, the then Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, who then served later in Bush Jr.'s administration, and Robert McFarlane, I guess he was the Chief of Staff at the time. So,
And Claridge and Claire George.
Yeah, all these guys. I mean, he pardoned them just before he left office, of course. Yep. And Ray goes on to tell the story of how he, of course, Ray McGovern, was the briefer of two presidents, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and he also briefed Bush as vice president. the CIA briefer every day going into the Oval Office. Now, Ray kept a good relationship with George Bush even after he left office, and they would write letters to each other periodically. And in the lead up to the Iraq War, just before the invasion, in January of 2003, Ray McGovern wrote to George Bush saying he was worried about what Bush Sr. used to call the crazies in the basement, meaning the neocons. And that George Bush was seen as some kind of paleoconservative, you know, supposedly didn't like these neocons, but his son had embraced them. So Ray said, "I'm really worried. I'm really concerned that I'm aghast at the cavalier way in which the Richard Perles of the Pentagon are promoting the use of nuclear weapons as an acceptable option against Iraq." And he asked Bush if he would speak privately to his son about right. these crazies who were advising him on invading Iraq. And George Bush wrote back a handwritten note to Ray McGovern that we reproduce here in the article that Ray saved on January 22, 2003. And Ray, he says, "Dear Ray, it's only meet and right that you speak out. Thanks for your letter. Please do not worry that crazies have any influence on POTUS 43. Here he is not calling his son by his name, right. calling him POTUS 43. I will admit that early reporting indicated that, but it was not true then. Not true now. Right. And as it is not true now."
Right.
Now, he's lying because right. later in his in a biography of Bush, he admitted that Bush, his son, had what he called iron-assed. I hope you don't have to beep that.
Iron-assed advisors.
Iron-assed advisors. He meant Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Right.
So he, you know, he saw the truth, but he lied to Ray directly, saying, "Don't worry about it. He's getting good advice. They're not taking over."
Right.
And the rest is unfortunately a horrible, murderous history in Iraq.
Yeah. I mean, Ray says Junior was a poster child for a crying need in this country for basic instruction on parenting.
Yes. Yeah. And Ray's inimical way.
Yep.
That's right. So, horrible.
All right. So we've got a couple other topics to cover, and we've got about 5 minutes to do it. So let's jump out. What else did you want? You wanted to get?
I want to talk about the Yellow Vest story by Diana Johnston that we published just today.
Yeah, let's do that. Yes.
Well, Diana gives a very long explanation of the economic difficulties facing the French population because of this Rothschild Bank installed neoliberal king, as he's being called. I'm talking about Emmanuel Macron, who you could see right away what this guy was going to do. And he's done it, and he's angered even more the French population. Unlike the American population, the French go out on the streets, at least enough of them to make the news and to make a problem, such a problem that the main demand they had was the revocation of this new tax on petrol, and it was done. They won, basically, at least on that one. But the whole raft of neoliberal policies that were already beginning to be introduced by previous President Sarkozy, France had resisted that to some extent. You know, Mitterrand, even up to that, they had nationalized banks, and they did not buy what was then called like a British economy or American-British economy. They resisted the Milton Friedman, Reagan, Thatcher introduction of neoliberal politics, which is essentially deprivatization, cutting back social welfare programs, and various things like that that hurt the working people of the country and transfer enormous amounts of wealth from the population to the 1%.
Right.
And in France, they resisted that in the government for a long time, and then Sarkozy brought it in, but it's now been completed under Macron, and this is the response. These people getting in the streets wearing these yellow vests that I didn't know until I read Diana's piece are by law required to be in each car. Every driver must right. have one. So if they break down and they have to get into the road at night, they will be reflected right. And they'll be seen. I thought that this was a good opportunity to invest in companies that made these vests, but they had already been made. I didn't know that.
They're out there already. Yeah, yeah.
Because it's spreading to Netherlands and Germany. This is what's interesting. See, when you get a symbolic thing like that, the yellow vest, you need something like that to spread this unrest against the same kind of neoliberal policies across Europe, particularly Greece, of course, was hard hit. This is the bankers in control, scooping up the dough, screwing the workers, and the people have had enough of that. And we hope someday the U.S. could do this, but we're so disorganized here. And we have, again, like in Europe, the right-wing populism is leading the charge. And this is what Diana's story is about. She's saying this is the reality. There is no left. Of course, we need a left popularism. It's not developing. But she seems to take the position that let's take this what we have. At least they're rising up against these policies, even if they're right wingers. Of course, at this moment, that's correct. But if they should get power, there would be a lot of policies the right wing populists have, that anti-immigration, etc., that, and some of them are climate deniers, change deniers, that would not be good. But at this level on the street, at least somebody's getting out there, even if they're part of the right wing populist movement. But we're not seeing that here in the U.S. Trump has continued neoliberal policies here, but he's got his base duped. They're not protesting anywhere near like any at all like what we see in France today.
You know, this is a lot to carry, and we've got about a minute and a half. But the it's early yet, I think, for a response. I mean, a response based on the material to whatever Trump does with the economy, since. You know, you change the terms of NAFTA, or you walk away from the TPP, or you do the tax cut and try to encourage repatriation of capital and investment in factories, whatever. Then there is, you know, pipeline time from the implementation of the policy, even if it's successful. I mean, that's another question, because it hasn't ripened yet. And there are some real strong contraindications in history. But, you know, from the time that the ink dries on the legislation to the time that the first jobs are created to the time that the first paychecks are issued under those jobs and maybe the 10th paycheck, you have a period of a couple of years. And so you haven't really had that kind of a period for an assessment on the ground of whether or not Trump has succeeded in keeping his promises to those people. However, you do have the fundamental unrest among the population. It even predates Trump. In fact, Trump is one of several manifestations of that. So was Sanders. In essence, a loss of legitimacy of the institutions that are supposed to, you know, remedy those problems that people have been facing now for decades. That's something that is shared across the U.S., Europe, and good parts of Asia, and I think that's something we're going to have to keep our eye on, and maybe we can pick up there next week, because we are out of time.
Okay, Don, thank you very much.
Thank you for all the work you're doing. You're doing a hell of a job over there at ConsortiumNews.com.
Well, I appreciate it. It's good, nice to hear that, believe me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the efforts to force the publisher of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he will be extradited to the United States to stand trial with journalist Joe Lord.
When she calls journalists his colleagues, this chill, put a chill one down my back, because they are not acting like his colleagues. They're abandoning him, and it's really, they don't know what they're doing to themselves ultimately. But this is not the way to think. I think even alternative media, so-called left media, you know, they still need the establishment to vindicate, to verify them, to validate them. They've been broken off with them. They want to be in their hierarchy of celebrity in this nonsense. So Assange is bad. He gave us Trump. That's what they're saying. And it's really absurd.
Julian Assange's sanctuary in the Ecuadorian embassy in London has been transformed into a little shop of horrors. He has been largely cut off from communicating with the outside world for the last 7 months. His Ecuadorian citizenship, granted to him as an asylum seeker, is in the process of being revoked. His health is failing. He's being denied medical care. His efforts for legal redress have been crippled by the gag rules, including Ecuadorian orders that he cannot make public his conditions inside the embassy in fighting for revocation of his Ecuadorian citizenship. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to intercede on behalf of Assange, an Australian citizen, even though the new government in Ecuador led by Lenin Moreno, who calls Assange an inherited problem and an impediment to better relations with Washington, is making the WikiLeaks founder's life in the embassy unbearable. Almost daily, the embassy is imposing harsher conditions for Assange, including making him pay for his medical bills, imposing arcane rules about how he must care for his cat, and demanding that he perform a variety of demeaning housekeeping chores. The Ecuadorians, reluctant to expel Assange after granting him political asylum and citizenship, intend to make his existence so unpleasant he will agree to leave the embassy, to be arrested by the British and extradited to the United States. The former president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, whose government granted the publisher political asylum, describes Assange's current living conditions as torture. Joining me to discuss the persecution of Julian Assange is Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News. So you're one of the few journalists in the country who has decided to defend the rights of publishers. I find what's happening so incredibly short-sighted on the part of the press. Does it surprise you?
I'd like to say yes, but I can't, because we've seen, as you've chronicled very well over the years, the decline of American journalism with all the other institutions that you've also chronicled. And that is this rampant careerism, this taking of official statements and positions and just reporting them without question, that has opened up such a void that Julian Assange actually filled so well with WikiLeaks. And of course, when he revealed what George Bush did, the Democrats were happy with him and the Republicans weren't. And now, vice versa, when he revealed the DNC and Podesta emails, we have Democrats across in the establishment, even rank-and-file Democrats, wanting to see Julian Assange brought back to the U.S. in chains. It's abominable, especially the media going along with this, not standing up for him as a publisher. And of course, the New York Times realizes, because their number two counsel was out on the West Coast a couple of months ago speaking to some judges, and he said, we don't really want Assange to be arrested because they can come after us. And
well, it sets a legal precedent that the Trump administration and perhaps the next administration will be quite happy to use.
Well, the Obama administration looked into prosecuting him, and they came up with what they called the New York Times problem, was if we get him, that the New York Times is liable. I must point out, however, some people believe there is no legal basis to prosecute. There is. There is. The Espionage Act has a section that actually criminalizes possession and reception of classified information and its dissemination. It happens to be subsection C, section 793. And then there's also the Pentagon Papers case. I wrote a book with Senator Mike Gravel back 10 years ago when he briefly ran for president. He, of course, was the senator that Dan Ellsberg gave the Pentagon Papers to read into the congressional record under the speech and debate clause of the Constitution, which allows any member to say anything they want. They can declassify anything if it's in a legislative act and they can't be questioned for it. I remember Dick Durbin, after in the Senate, said, well, I couldn't reveal that we knew there were no WMD because it was classified, which was rubbish. He could have under that debate. But in that case, Gravel, what the Pentagon Papers case showed and the Supreme Court decision was that the government cannot use prior restraint and cannot tell a newspaper, before publishing, you can't publish it. But after publishing, as Byron White, one of the justices in that case, pointed out, there are other ways the government could go after them. It's still classified, and the issue is it's politically not possible until now. Legally, it's been possible. They've never dared do that since John Peter Zenger back in 1735, right here in Manhattan, when William Cosby, the governor of British governor of New York, prosecuted him for libel because he wrote some things against the governor, and he went to trial, and of course, the jury was made a decision that it was true and he was free. That's the foundation, the beginning before the country, obviously in colonial America, of our First Amendment. This would be the second major case of that type since that. That's almost 300 years ago, to bring Julian Assange here, a publisher, because he did not steal the documents himself.
Right.
He merely received and published them. So politically, it looks like the Trump administration might actually do it because they don't have opposition from the Democrats and the population at large, distracted or disinterested. And this is very troubling.
Let's turn to a clip. Julian Assange's mother, Christine Assange, issued an appeal. So let's just watch a couple minutes of this. She talks about Julian's case, which I want to get into after she begins the discussion.
despite Julian being a multi-award-winning journalist, much loved and respected for courageously exposing serious, high-level crimes and corruption in the public interest. He is right now alone, sick, in pain, silenced in solitary confinement, cut off from all contact, and being tortured in the heart of London. The modern-day cage for political prisoners is no longer the Tower of London. It is the Ecuadorian embassy. Here are the facts. Julian has been detained nearly 8 years without charge. That's right, without charge. For the past 6 years, the UK government has refused his request for access to basic health needs, fresh air, exercise, sunshine for vitamin D, and access to proper medical and dental care. As a result, his health has seriously deteriorated, and his examining doctors warn these detention conditions are life-threatening. A slow and cruel assassination is taking place before our very eyes in the embassy in London. In 2016, after an in-depth investigation, the United Nations ruled that Julian's legal and human rights had been violated on multiple occasions, that he had been illegally detained since 2010, and they ordered his immediate release, safe passage, and compensation. The UK government refused to abide by the UN decision. The US government has stated Julian's arrest is a priority. They want to get round the US journalist protections under their First Amendment by charging him with espionage. They will stop at nothing to do it. As a result of the US bearing down on Ecuador, his asylum is now under immediate threat. The US pressure on Ecuador's new president resulted in Julian being placed into strict and severe solitary confinement for the last 7 months, deprived of any contact with his family and friends. Only his lawyers could see him. 2 weeks ago, things became substantially worse. The former president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, who rightfully gave Julian political asylum from US threats against his life and liberty, publicly warned that when US Vice President Mike Pence recently visited Ecuador, a deal was done to hand Julian over to the US. He stated that because of the political cost of expelling Julian from their embassy was too high, the plan was to break him down mentally. A new, impossible, inhumane set of rules and protocols was implemented at the embassy to torture him to such a point that he will break and be forced to leave.
So let's talk about why Julian is there in the first place.
Well, he knew early on from 2011 there was the idea amongst his lawyers and himself that there was an indictment sealed. Now we know for sure because it was
mistakenly revealed.
That's a whole show right there about that mistake. So now we know there definitely is an indictment waiting for him. So he knew that if he were arrested by the British government or by the Swedish government at the time of the sexual abuse allegations that he could.
Which were later dropped.
Totally. He was never charged with any crime. He was back in the 80s, apparently, for some hacking, but not in the current time
right.
We're talking about. He's never been charged with that. That is always reported wrongly by everybody. He wasn't charged with a crime. He was under investigation. There was an arrest warrant because they wanted to question him. Ultimately, the British government, and we know from Stefania Morizzi from the La Repubblica, from her FOIA searches, that the British government put a lot of pressure on Sweden not to come to London to question him. They wanted him out of there to go out of the embassy or to Sweden.
And we should be clear that he was given diplomatic, protection or within asylum within the embassy, but the British would not grant him safe passage from the embassy to the airport.
They wouldn't allow him to get a diplomatic passport, by the way, either.
Yeah,
wouldn't allow
also
him to get out. So that's why he's been there, and now we know he cannot go. He will certainly be extradited to the United States. The British Defense Secretary said the British police will give him a warm welcome once he leaves the embassy. That's why he's there. That's why he can't leave.
You know, you had at the, especially with the material that Chelsea Manning provided to WikiLeaks, he was feted and courted by the very media institutions that have now turned against him, The Guardian, The New York Times, because they wanted his material.
Yes, and why? Whose government did he expose then? Republican government, George W. Bush. So liberal media loved Julian Assange then. He's now exposed the Democrats.
Right.
This man is nonpartisan. He's nonpartisan. But people in this hyperpartisan time we're living in cannot understand it. They can't grasp what this means, to not take a side in two major political parties that have barely any difference on most major issues, particularly foreign policy. So, but they branded him, you know, a guy who got Hillary Clinton to lose the election, which is complete nonsense. And it's all gotten muddled up in the Russiagate mania that we've been living through for 2 years. So he would come here and become part of the focus, perhaps, of even the Mueller investigation if they could pin something on him. But again, the Russians, whoever gave it to him, should be immaterial.
Well, I worked for 20 years abroad. I was leaked all sorts of material by all sorts of groups, from the French intelligence service to the FMLN rebels in El Salvador to the PKK rebels to the Mossad to the CIA and the FBI. And what's important is whether those documents are genuine or forged. And it's very clear the Podesta emails were genuine. And from those emails, what did we learn? We learned that the Clinton Foundation received millions of dollars from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, two of the major funders of the Islamic State. We learned that Hillary Clinton, as the Secretary of State, paid her donors back by approving $80 billion in weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, which, of course, has now been used to prosecute the humanitarian crisis and war in Yemen, where half the country now is chronically short of food. There's a cholera epidemic, 60,000 dead. We learned that Hillary Clinton was paid $675,000 for speaking at Goldman Sachs, a sum so large it can only be described as a bribe. We learned that in these closed talks, she told the financial elites that she supported open trade and open borders, and that she believed the Wall Street executives were, in her words, best positioned to manage the economy, which flatly contradicted her campaign promises. We learned that the Clinton campaign worked very hard to make sure Donald Trump was the Republican nominee. We learned that Clinton received advance information on primary debate questions. We learned, because there are 1,700 of the 33,000 emails from Clinton, that she was the architect of the war in Libya, that she believed it would burnish her credentials as a presidential candidate, and what has Libya, the chaos in Libya, resulted in. It's seen the rise of radical jihadists in a failed state. It's triggered a massive exodus of migrants into Europe. It's seen Libyan weapons stockpiles seized by rogue militias and Islamic radicals, and it's resulted in 40,000 dead. And the question is this: should this information have remained hidden from the American public? And I would say that if you argue that, you can't call yourself a journalist.
Absolutely. I wrote a book, and Julian wrote the foreword all about those emails. So, and you left out one that New York Times reporters were giving their copy to the campaign members to check before. I mean, this is just absolute fireable offense in a newspaper. But look, anybody who leaks information has a motive. Okay, and their motive is to help their self-interest. So when American officials do it as well, whether that's Mossad, Russians, State Department, you'd look at whether it's true or not, and if it's newsworthy. That's really all you got to
do.
And that's it. And this was, certainly. And it was not politically motivated on his part. If he had Trump documents, he would have leaked them. He didn't get the Republican emails.
Right.
They got a bunch. They checked it out. They'd already been published. But Trump was an open book anyway. We knew what he was. Clinton was a closed book, so these helped the voter understand who she was.
We'll come back to that. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about freedom of the press and Julian Assange with journalist and editor Joe Loria.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to On Contact. We continue our conversation about freedom of the press and Julian Assange with Consortium editor-in-chief Joe Loria. So, He's essentially Assange I think, which has earned the deep anger of what we would call the deep state for all of these, for exposing the crimes of empire, exposing, as we spoke about earlier, the duplicity of the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign, and then, of course, exposing the hacking tools that the CIA used. You can explain what that was.
Well, the Vault 7, I think set off the CIA. They spent billions of dollars developing this, and they lost control of it.
Explain what it is.
Well, it was a bunch of things in there, obviously, but the main points were how they could use a TV to spy on us at home, etc. But especially this Marble program that was discussed, which was where the CIA had spent billions over years to develop, where they could go into metadata on a hack and put in fingerprints, so-called, of other actors in Iranian, in Persian, in or Farsi, I should say, in Russian, in Arabic, etc., to make it look like somebody else did the hack. This was really a key one. So it was blown, but they lost control of it, and then it was given to a WikiLeaks, and they published it. And this was a huge embarrassment to the CIA. But in general, what you were saying, the crimes that they have committed, people who are still alive today working in our government, running things, he is a direct threat to them because he's doing what a journalist is supposed to do. And most of our journalists aren't in the corporate media anymore, expose what they're up to. And of course, throughout history, any ruling circles are going to blame a foreign hostile power or the media. They did it during Vietnam. They blame the media for losing the war, etc. So we've got this whole thing on steroids now that he's like the enemy number one. And WikiLeaks won't stop, incidentally, even if they get him. But they want to make an example of him and they want his sources. And that's why it's not a fantasy to think he could be ill-treated as well. If he's captured.
He's not an American citizen. He shouldn't be subject to the Espionage Act. He's not bound by any law that I know of to protect American secrets. What's the legal basis?
Well, that's a good point. If he were on U.S. soil doing this, he would be, obviously. If you go to another country and you break their laws, they can arrest you. But this was done from abroad. But, you know, U.S. has had this extraterritorial jurisdiction going on for years now and all sorts of things. So they think they're running the whole world,
well,
or much of it.
It began with extraordinary rendition of Muslims who were not American citizens. And, of course, all of us who were speaking out about it said they are not going to stop. You've created a precedence by which dissidents are next. And this, of course,
is the major example of what's happened.
Let's listen again to Christine Assange, a short clip here.
They are setting my son up to give them an excuse to hand him over to the U.S., where he will face a show trial. Over the past 8 years, he has had no proper legal process. It has been unfair at every turn, with much perversion of justice. There is no reason to consider that this would change in the future. The U.S. WikiLeaks grand jury producing the extradition warrant is held in secret, has 4 prosecutors but no defence and no judge. The UK-US extradition treaty allows for the UK to extradite Julian to the US without a prima facie case. Once in the US, the National Defence Authorisation Act allows for indefinite detention without trial. Julian could very well be held in Guantanamo Bay and tortured, sentenced to 45 years in a maximum security prison or face the death penalty. My son is in critical danger because of a brutal political persecution by the bullies in power whose crimes and corruption he has courageously exposed when he was editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks.
Let's talk about what it looks like, because there's long been the assumption that there were sealed grand jury indictments out of Virginia, right?
Alexandria, where I'm living, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we now have seen tangential proof of that. But let's talk a little bit about, as far as you can tell, how you think they will legally attempt to prosecute Assange if they extradite him.
Well, I was just reading about, they could go off of the question of him having published secrets to try to prove somehow that he took part in the theft of the government documents. And there was this case in Iceland where the FBI went there and they tried to, according to some people, frame him and WikiLeaks for having ordered certain hacks of Icelandic government institutions.
Well, didn't they pay a bribe, quite a hefty bribe, to former WikiLeaks member to essentially say that?
Yes.
Right.
He snitched. And then the Interior Minister kicked out the FBI. So that didn't work. But there could be something like that, that they want to try to prove that he was actively involved. Now, as you well know, Chris, you get sources, you are trying to encourage them, you want more information out of them. At what point is that like, go there into that drawer and steal that document from him? You're not going to say that.
Why is that important to them legally?
Well, because it's a crime to steal documents.
Right. It's not a crime to publish them.
Well, it could be. As I said, under this espionage, it's been politically untenable to do it until now. They can't do it. Nixon didn't do it to Gravel. He could have. He got the Pentagon Papers published at Boston and Beacon Press, and the FBI raided Beacon Press at that time. But they didn't prosecute because they couldn't get away with it because of the sense of the First Amendment, that you cannot punish a publisher for publishing documents that he didn't steal, that he just received. But you can do it. But that's why this would be an unbelievable case if it happens. It would be an unbelievable precedent, which is why the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN, they don't want this to happen. Their lawyers don't want this to happen. Because especially with Trump, the way he feels about the media, that's why I think they may do it. He's so crazed about it. And then he could go after them.
Yeah, of course. How would they use the Espionage Act? The Espionage Act, 1917, the equivalent of our version of the British Foreign Secrets Act, was written to prosecute people who were giving information to a hostile power. How would the Espionage Act...
There have been additions to it. That was originally just a war, about the First World War. But the additions, including subsection C, section 793, says if you receive these documents and disseminate them, you're liable to prosecution. It's in the statutes. It's in the act. It's never been used for that purpose.
Right.
It would be extraordinary. It's been misused by the Obama administration against people like Tom Drake, et cetera, the Espionage Act, where he gave some information that wasn't classified. In the end, it was proven to the Baltimore Sun. But they charged him under the Espionage Act. So this is like, it's ridiculous. Even Ellsberg was not a spy, I mean, in that sense. And he was the other one of the other few ones before the Obama administration to be charged under it. So if they wanted to use this part of the Espionage Act, it would be an extraordinary political development that is never, no administration has done before. Not since, I said, back in colonial America. So that's what we're all worried about. And I don't think he'd get a fair trial. As Christine said, it would be a show trial because
right.
They could use the state secrets privilege. They can get to a point where they get a judge who has clearance. They can go in the chambers and tell the jury, we have classified information. Can't show you. Show the judge. He comes out and says, guilty. Go home. And the defense has never seen
the
evidence.
They use secret evidence against Muslim jihadists, which means that both the defendants and their lawyers can't even
see the
purported evidence that's being used to charge them.
That's correct. If it came to that, they'd use that. I think so. And as I said, he could be mistreated. They want his sources. And
right.
If they have him in custody, you never know what could happen to him.
From what you can tell, because you in Consortium News have written, you wrote about an attempted break-in. And it's difficult because his communications have been cut off. What, as far as you can tell, are his living conditions like at this
They're
moment?
They're getting worse and worse, clearly, as we're coming to the moment when he's probably going to...
And what have you heard?
I've heard now that this cat that the media went over crazy about,
which
was a side story, but now it's gone, and that meant something to him. I haven't confirmed that.
Right.
I've heard that he went a couple of days without food because his lawyers aren't allowed there every day anymore. There was a bank holiday in London. He went 3 days without food. I haven't confirmed that either. But the overall effect is the security. The door is open. People can walk in the embassy. Somebody did it again last night and filmed it and put it on Twitter. So the sense is the place is open, and they're making it extremely difficult for him to stay there. So they'd rather he leave on his own than have to go through to expelling him because of the legal complications in Ecuador.
Let's have one last clip from Christine Assange.
We need to make our protest against this brutality deafening. I call on all you journalists to stand up now. Because he is your colleague and you are next. I call on all you politicians who say you entered Parliament to serve the people to stand up now. I call on all you activists who support human rights, refugees, the environment and are against war to stand up now because WikiLeaks has served the causes that you fight for and Julian is now suffering for it alongside of you. I call on all citizens who value freedom, democracy and a fair legal process to put aside your political differences and unite and stand up now. Most of us don't have the courage of our whistleblowers or the journalists like Julian Assange who published them so that we may be informed and warned about the abuses of power.
Chilling.
It's up to us because the institutions, There's nothing within the institutions that are going to stop this.
When she calls journalists his colleagues, chill went down my back because they are not acting like his colleagues. They're abandoning him. And it's really, they don't know what they're doing to themselves, ultimately. But this is not the way to think. I think even alternative media, so-called left media, you know, they still need the establishment to vindicate, to verify them, to validate them. They haven't broken off with them. They want to be in their hierarchy of celebrity and this nonsense. Right. So Assange is bad. He gave us Trump. That's what they're saying. And it's really absurd.
And dangerous. It's a very
extremely
dangerous moment in American history.
It really is historic, yes.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay.
That was Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of Consortium News.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.